I hope the audience is enjoying this conversation as much as I am. We're talking with Jim Channon, a global strategic designer. And for the next hour, we're going to go down a list of ideas that he has to shape our future on a global level. I'm going to start with number 11, that we accept the notion that life is more likely to exist in the galaxy than not, and prepare for the real benefits of what Jim calls new connections. We'll get into that right after this. Stay with us on Coast to Coast. Welcome back. My guest is Jim Channon, global strategic designer. Jim, I saved this article. It appeared in the journal Science back in September, and the headline is Human-Made Crises Outrunning Our Ability to Deal with Them, Scientists Warn. And in this article, they talk about pointing to the need for global action on such things as energy, food and water crises, climate disruption, declining fisheries, ocean acidification, emerging diseases, global scale challenges that are outpacing the development of institutions, in particular government, to deal with them. Sounds like exactly what you're talking about.
That's the situation, and of course, all trumped up by the fear-based press systems and that we have, and most of all, the last century power centers who are trying to keep their legitimacy by scaring us into their solutions. I've done seven different global plans, and related to how the heck we get on the right course, I tried to match something we needed to do with a working constituency out there of some kind. In other words, especially what do we do with the people who are not currently employed? Like, what about grade school kids? They're not fully employed. What about middle school kids? What about high school kids? It's what about college kids? And so there's a set of tasks that each of them can add to what they do. Then there's the whole list of things I gave you about the four branches of service, each having specific responsibilities at the biosphere level. And so it goes. Every industrial organization has an obligation to make a paradigm shift. And, it's like Ted Turner started the donating thing, and then the other people jump on. So there'll be a little bit of, come on, boys, follow us. So, and when I say that, it's not flippant. When I worked for Royal Dutch Shell, as a strategic designer, I had to remind them that almost every tool they had that moved oil could move fresh water. Those kind of paradigm shifts are available, and on some of my websites, they're broken out in great detail, how all those shifts can occur. So we've got our armies involved, the big corporate headquarters involved, school kids involved. Let's leave the working people alone for now. But, by the way, malls that are dying can become new global villages by simply moving the fresh farm goods right in and the entertainment right in, revitalize those elements. And let's see.
Let's stick with the oil company thing, realizing that they are, you said, liquid transportation companies.
Right.
I'm imagining it's going to take a while to convince them that moving water is a better idea than moving oil, considering how much money they make moving oil.
A quart of water costs more than a quart of oil. Yeah, I know. But especially if we move into a wideband energy system, which we have to, and just stop relying on two or three big sources, they're going to have to do something. They can either move into the new sources in a distributed way, but they're going to get it. There's so many ways that oil needs to be saved now. We forget that so many of our plastic implements, I mean, the most useful tools on the planet are like plastic buckets and plastic chairs. They come from oil. So, God, if we run out just driving around, what a crime. But there are equivalent kinds of shifts for almost every type of company that I've worked with. I worked with a Japanese company, for instance, and they said, we are making so much money making this small computer part in that we don't know what to do with our people. And I said, well, just send them home at noon. And, of course, the Japanese women wouldn't have anything to do with that. So in the afternoon now, they change their little white jackets into little green jackets and little green gloves, and they go out and make farm. They have a farm. So they're the first world's birth bifunctional company. So that's possible for workforces. You don't have to send them home or fire them all. You just get versatile about what they do.
I can't imagine what you would do to the Japanese divorce rate if the guys are coming home in the afternoon.
Oh, we would. It would be a bloodbath. Pound for pound, the Japanese woman is the most intrepid creature on the planet, I think.
Back to the oil company thing. You're not one of those who buys that we can drill our way out of this.
No, what's happening, my inside information is that the places that still have oil very often are not supported by soil that allows us to get the oil out. We used to dig a hole here, put a pump in, push it, it would come out the other end because the soil stayed in place. Now, evidently, in places like in the Middle East, the sand all gets mushed in with it, and the profit of trying to clean it up on the other end is not good. So, no, and it's just good for our health to move into a diversified power system. I have on my little ranchette here, I have solar, I have a firewood for certain events, you know, I have water catchment, but I still employ the power company half the time now and the water company half the time. So we need to sort of move into that graceful place where they don't have to completely disappear themselves, the big organizations, but share the load. We all move into the country. By the way, rich people, you know what they do when they make a lot of money? They go out in the country and buy an estate, and that's where they could actually survive a crisis. And most of the smart people I know are moving into families of 8 to 12 people. They're all mixed in terms of relationships, but they all have a certain focus on sustainability. My land is 3 acres. I have 12 people. We will be sustainable in the year 2012 because I've got 65 fruit-bearing trees in an agroforest 7-layer system, and they will be coming on with full production next year. And right now, we can provide half of the food we need. And we are loving being in the country. I mean, excuse me, I'm going to have to come out of the closet here. I fell in love with planet Earth. Is that okay?
I guess so.
Outside, I mean, before I got your call, I was looking at the 6 biggest trees I have that I've put in within 20 years, and they're huge. One of them's a bamboo stand, and one's a royal palm. And these are for me real deep-rooted objects and foundations of my life. I know my plants. I know I have 70 species on my land. It's organized like a botanical garden and a farm, and you can't tell one from the other. And so we're going to – that's what – individuals and families have the option to do is go back, like Thomas Jefferson said, and help out on the small farm.
How does a family living in the inner city in Detroit or New York or something that has limited resources, paycheck to paycheck living, how do they realistically expect to move to the country or join a commune or do the kinds of things that you're talking about?
Well, they get out their high school yearbook, and they find somebody they know that lives in the country. They drive out, make a meeting with them, provide a little money maybe for a place, small place, or a yurt or some kind of tent, get a little bit invested psychologically in the land, and then be aware enough so that when the shortages come, they get out of town before everybody else is trying to get out of town. Meantime, they have a lot of stuff growing on the roof. It's, again, like almost every one of the solutions for the future is a wideband solution. It's not this or that. It's this and that. It's just like serial entrepreneurs have turned into parallel entrepreneurs now. Like a fisherman with 5 different fishing poles and different bait on each one, and you still live at home.
You know, you talked about being in love with planet Earth. I ran a search and was looking for other people's opinions of you and your ideas, and I found this blog, a lady who described you as Luciferian,
Yeah,
that
what is that?
you're practicing the big lie, that you're spreading dangerous propaganda, and I think it's the religious connotation that you would worship Earth instead of God.
I'm aware that God exists, but I just can't put it in an old guy's body with a beard, you know? I'm very spiritual. But the two most miraculous evidences we have that God exists are, first of all, the human body and how it functions, including all the animals and the planet itself, and the billions of entities that intermingle on the planet magically. Yeah, I don't even know what a Luciferian is, okay? I've never even, I only heard the word on a commercial you guys had. But if you want to know somebody who's against dogmatic thinking, you know, that would be me. I mean, let's keep the country churches because that's the best gathering place we have for people in the country. But, you know, shut up from the pulpit, you know, sing more.
One of the things on your list that I found very intriguing is this one, that we accept the notion that life is more likely to exist in the galaxy than not, and prepare for the real benefits of new connections. You sort of alluded to this in the previous hour when you made reference to these five intelligences. I don't know if that means aliens, if it means angels, something else that we can't quite grasp. What do you
There's
think
the
it is?
whole it, my taxonomy is very preliminary because I haven't been in this world a long time, but I do know that what I gather is there are types of intelligences in the universe that don't have bodies. Then there are types that do have bodies. Then there are types that can change their bodies. There are well, let me go back to the practical part of this. The practical part is about 5 years ago, right up near my house, they put a new laser system into the telescopes that looked out into the galaxy. And what it allowed them to do was to calibrate the light inferences around the star systems and adjust it so that the cameras could take better pictures. And what they found out, and do you know this? That every single star system is surrounded by planets. Did you know that?
Well, I know we keep finding them out there. The list is more than 300, and we just started looking a couple of years ago.
Well, the actual list is now in the billions. Now, why isn't that news out there? It just blows me away. That's almost the biggest event of the century. And it means that every single star or sun naturally somehow either births planets naturally. And that's easy for me to get because stars are mostly dust and heat. And so they could spin off a flare. It could be in the spinning mode. It would turn into like a Christmas tree ornament and heal itself with about 20 miles of skin. And that's exactly how they could be balanced around. This old gravity idea is a pretty basic idea. Most of the ideas I'm getting from the quantum side is that frequency patterns are what hold the planets in place, not gravity. And everything out there isn't a ball of lead, you know. It's very ephemeral, like Christmas tree ornaments, much more, and also way more biological than the academics. Some of the folks I speak with from the other star systems say, you guys are stuck in propulsion. You got hooked on the automobile engine, and you can't find any other kind of science that really excites you. And and here's an inference that people, the grown-ups in the galaxy, don't go anywhere in spaceships. They just adjust the frequency pattern and arrive at the place they're supposed to. And these guys around us, perhaps, are, you know, sort of the lower grade outcasts in the system. And I don't think, by the way, they're flying actual ships. I think what they're doing is flying decompression chambers because shifting from one location gravity-wise is a difference, and they have to decompress. So that's why there are such silly little bowls. You know, they're not very – have you ever seen a really aerodynamic spaceship? I haven't.
You know, on this topic, in this program, we talk about UFOs and other kinds of intelligences quite often, and the resistance of mainstream science to even acknowledging the possibility. I mean, you got mainstream scientists say, yeah, it's possible that there's life out there somewhere. They couldn't be coming here. That's impossible. And they don't want to hear any contrary opinions.
Well, I'm a language specialist, and one of the things I invented to do my job was visual language. So I can assemble a great number of ideas just by using shapes and then making the shapes look like they're going somewhere, and that's what all these corporate strategies look like. Well, when I look at crop circles, of course I can imagine a couple of guys getting together and going out and faking one of these things and maybe getting away with it. But, you know, 1,000 crop circles later, wait a minute, what's their incentive for doing this? They're going to go anonymous and they're going to get up and do this every night? Silly. And what I know by study, I took 64 crop circles and put them out and did a graphic language analysis on them. And there is an art director here. I recognize a pattern of art when I see it, a certain combination. And I think what you're looking at when you look at a crop circle is a verb, meaning this is a picture of a complex process. Now, if you knew what the complex process was applied to, like maybe air conditioning or maybe propulsion, then it would make more sense to you. But if I make a graphic, for instance, of a catalyst that goes on an automobile and a catalytic converter, for example, what happens is something goes in one side, it's changed two different ways, and you see those in the crop circles, two things, two different patterns, and it's probably, hopefully, takes two things away. So a lot of crop circles to me look like catalytic converters or disks inside of high-energy devices. And occasionally you get something that looks like a craft. And then, of course, you get all the orbital dynamics. You know, you've seen all the ones where there's obviously a sun, and the same symbol is used all the time for sun. And then there's a planet over here. Then it shows the gravitational pull between the two. And, of course, the reason they send them to the Earth like that is because they bypass all of the control agencies that won't tell us the truth. And they've told us that they're not going to tell us the truth. But I am really sure, George, as an expert in visual language, that those are verbs. They're sending us advanced ways to see processes. And one of the weakest things about the English language is it has too many nouns and wimpy verbs.
Well, you know, the crop circles aren't even really circles anymore. These intricate designs that, you know, you can see Doug and Dave, the old barflies, taking boards out and creating some here and there, and teams of more intrepid and energetic guys creating something here and there. But the idea that they somehow weave the crops and create genetic changes in the plants themselves, it seems to be a message of some sort, subliminal, appealing to us on a different level. I don't know if they're verbs or not, but it's just letting us know that something's going on that we don't completely comprehend.
Well, I can judge, you know, as an aesthetic person that studies cultures, that these are elegant designs. They're balanced from a point of view, artful design. They're balanced. They're beautiful. They have energy in them. They suggest movement. Almost all of them suggest certain kinds of movement. So there's a common thread that runs through every one of them pretty much. And we don't get a ducky and a horsey, you know? That's an old joke I remember from school. Is it okay? We're looking at the cloud. If I just see a ducky and a horsey, yeah, but no. This is art. It's high level art. It's communicated in a practical way. Then the crops grow even better the next year. Now, come on, this is not us.
Jim Channon, I'm enjoying this conversation greatly. We'll come back and get into more of your suggestions for a global strategic design. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast AM. We're having a conversation with Jim Channon. One of the suggestions that Jim makes is that universities build upon the science of conscious evolution, a visionary mindset, and life force living intelligence, and then structure the experience-based curricula to that end. What does that mean, and do we have time to make the kinds of changes that he envisions? We'll get into that and more right after this. Stay with us on Coast to Coast. Welcome back, Jim Channon. Earlier in the program, you mentioned something about 12 other realities and how some people that you know are able to tap into six of them. Other realities meaning what? Parallel universe, alternate dimension? Is there a way even to describe what it is?
Well, those are two words that continue to work. Interdimensional, transdimensional, wormhole dimensional. You know, all the places that imagine the internet writ large galactically. You know, good grief. Anyway, so first of all, the dimensions that are available to us right now are, for example, the botanical dimension. And I know that I can definitely tune in at a certain psychic level with my plants. I can also notice when they are, you know, need something of a certain kind. I can feel them when they're happy. I can look at a tree and occasionally get it to create a wind doesn't come because it's pushed. It comes because it falls into a vacuum. And I can sit there and watch my trees pop wind and, you know, dance a bit for me. Now, I'm just sort of putting this all together and realizing that people who tune into the Davic realms and whatnot are not crazy. You know, they are really hooked up more than I am. So how about my cat? How about animals? And I swear to God, the other day when I gave something to my cat, it said thank you, and it sounded like thank you. No, I'm
so
sorry.
The men who stare at goats also talk to their cats and their plants.
My cat and my plants behave much better when I do. Now, I haven't gotten to the chicken that sits on my porch, but I have a chicken that just invaded my favorite chair on the porch. And I'm not sure why she's there, but she worships the beaded necklace that's right next to that hanging off. So then this exposure to the other star system information, which I can't verify yet, but I will know more. My job is to be the scout. My job is to pass back information that helps people fill in the blanks. You know, I can come up with the dots. Some people have to color in the lines, but it is completely within range that we will be communicating on many dimensions. People now, of course, on telephone can, you know, say hello, and somebody says hello, and then they say, "What's wrong with your liver?" Now, excuse me. That's interdimensional. So there is a bundle. I actually have been on Second Life, which is a virtual reality, and met people on Second Life. And just by typing simple questions to them, I actually get a sensation of their emotional state. Okay, that's interdimensional.
Forgive my ignorance. I don't know what Second Life is.
Second Life is a virtual reality that you can access on your computer. I don't know how many million people have been on there already, but it has about 40,000 people a day who inhabit a constructed world, which they build from their computer. They buy land, put up structures, meet other people. But the big thing in terms of interdimensional here is I go on this site, like walking in around a sim site, you know, simulated reality. But there are other people walking around there, but they're from Japan and Korea, and they're live. And their names are above their heads, and you can talk to them. In fact, my friend, one of my teammates, just had a meeting in a Hilton Hotel in Chicago with people from nine nations sitting in a meeting room. On the projected on the wall was the Second Life meeting room with 11 people from nine other nations. And the fidelity on the sound was so matched that you really couldn't tell who was in real reality and who was in virtual reality. And the veracity and the depth of the tone of the comments was real enough to assess, you know, emotional state.
One of the things on your list, you say that we should embrace a new level of profound simplicity and reintroduce creativity as a replacement for things and mindless entertainment. I don't know if virtual reality games count as mindless entertainment, but the suggestion is reminiscent of Thoreau for sure.
Well, virtual reality certainly can be mindful or mindless games for some who go in and all they do is build something, which is like having a train set in the basement. But for people who connect with people from other countries and make communication across those boundaries, and when you're talking, you know, 40,000 people a day doing that and all building little islands and they visit each other, like next to my island on Second Life is an Italian island with a casino on it. And when I fly in 6 seconds across to that island and land, I talk to Italians and I can play roulette with them. Now, isn't that an interesting way to mix international relations?
I would make sure I always won.
What's that?
Do you always win?
I'm not really as interested in the roulette as I am in the costumes of the ladies, actually. I'm a fashion aficionado, too. You know, for an old colonel, I'm pretty flexible.
One of your other suggestions, that universities build upon the science of conscious evolution, a visionary mindset, and life force living intelligence, and then structure their experience-based curricula to that end. Is that going to happen?
It has happened in moments here and there. Certainly in California, there are probably five institutions you can get a PhD in consciousness. But in this case, I'm talking about practical consciousness. Like, how little does the average man know when he walks up to a woman that he's interested in about actually assessing her energy field, willingness to participate, rapid eye movements, suggestive tone? Would he ask before he perhaps held her hand? Is he that awake? This is all about extending all of our processing skills, up-leveling all of our awareness skills. And that is the essential way you go into any problem-solving situation at a multidimensional level. And kids are ready for that. I mean, look at the movies that are popular out there now. Push, Paranormal Something Affair is out. And the kids they're pretty versatile in telekinesis. And I think on Push they had the Watchers and the Bleeders and the, you know. But already actively on that film, there were four paranormal skills embodied by each of the two teams that were sort of fighting each other. So there's not only a paranormal skill, but four of them being bundled intelligently. So anyway, schools are just classrooms full of categories. You know, we have all the categories for science and the categories for history and the activity of actually pursuing something you want to pursue creatively. Looking at it, modeling it, shaping it, putting it on the ground, you know, you're just wasting your time in school if you want that. Here's the deal. When we didn't have schools when we were going across America as stagecoaches, finally when we found a little building and somebody who could read or write and maybe do numbers, we put them in there, made them the teacher. Then all the kids who liked to do a read and write and made numbers came back to be the teacher. And all of them came back to be the teacher. It's the same people teaching school. The people who do things, make things, design things, they're not teachers. And that's why teaching at the schools now are just holding zones for kids who have too many hormones or something.
Here's one of your suggestions that I found, and not to be overly critical, but in the realm of wishful thinking, that the national military forces of the planet merge to form natural security teams, restore their respective parts of the Earth's forest, plant life, watersheds, wildlife, and the biosphere above all that. And that's a beautiful vision. But at some level, are we not a warlike by nature, warfare being a fact of human history since before there was history?
Yes, but the least warlike people I know are the people who have already been to war. And they will all tell you that it is unacceptably insane what happens on the front lines today, as it has for centuries. We are in the 21st century. We got to get better than this. And the Hollywood image of people in the army is a basic training image where everybody runs around and shouts and growls and has no flexibility. I would put a team of lieutenant colonels up against any diplomatic team, any scientific team, any corporate team on the planet in any kind of competition. And it would include lots of creativity. Because let's face it, can you imagine what it's like to be on a battlefield? It is chaos. Pulling that one together requires tons of awareness, tons of pre-planning and thinking. I mean, when I moved my platoon, every time I came to a new place, a new vantage point, I looked at the situation, looked at this, the cover, the concealment and everything, pre-fought the battle in my mind that might occur, and made my plans for that until I was at the end of that 500 feet and I had to do it again at the next 500 feet. No, people who run army posts, which are the best run towns on the planet and are separated from their families most of the time and are now in a civil affairs kind of counterinsurgency situation, are only too mindful of how dumb it all is. They would love to be doing something more intelligent and more constructive.
This vision, this vision, yeah, that government decentralizes into bioregions and organizes military units, school kids, fire departments, and others to generate food foraging forests in all available sites for complete global food security. It almost sounds, I know what people would say to that. That sounds Maoist. You know, it sounds like something.
Because they imagine that armies are already Maoist, that they're run by Teutonic, draconian people who are blunt-headed and not creative. All I really said was, break the governments up, put them in a regional support area, because the four regions of America are highly distinctly different from each other. So when you make laws in Washington, you marginalize all four of the regions because they have different capabilities and needs. And then I actually don't attach my thinking to any more than that, except to decentralize, distribute the talent, and get those people away from the money pot. As long as they can print money, we're in trouble.
And you discuss web-based democracies, dealing with problems on a regional basis. And sort of how and you also mentioned that the global public achieves this clear unifying identity. That would seem to be a threat to every government on the planet. And I would think that you'd have a lot of resistance there.
Well, because they're obsolete. You got to understand, governments were not created by God. They are social inventions. They were very useful for a certain period in history. And before them, you know, provinces and feudal lords were useful. And before that, tribal chieftains were useful. They are no longer helpful. They're actually the problem. Think about who starts wars and for what reason. You can find nations at the center of that. And nations are simply trying to outdo the nation, the government that was before them. I mean, they're not evil people either, but they're obsolete, and they're getting – let me put it this way. George, they're taking up too damn much space. They're making too much noise. They're distracting us from a good life, and they're paying off their buddies. You know, enough.
Well, I doubt you get many arguments from our listeners about that. There are not too many fans of government here.
Well, we hope that those listeners will get off their butts and do something about it, including walk away. Go to the country, build your survival the way you need to survive. And I'm not talking about the extreme survivalists here. The first step to paradise is called engage your land. And when you engage your land, you learn about water, and you learn about growing things, and you learn about the quality of soil. And if you ever want to get to paradise on this planet, you got to know that stuff.
I suppose if there isn't enough change, time for widespread change, that in case things hit the fan, that it's not bad to be prepared.
Well, it's good to be partly prepared and then finally convinced by the fan. And the primary objective of the World Business Academy goal for the 100 years is to see Earth as paradise. Now, there is no doubt in my mind that this Earth is qualified in every regard to be a paradise if we decide to think like that. Yes, and that's going to scare some religious people. Guess what? They're obsolete too. You know, doesn't make them bad. They just not, they're not with us. So paradise in one sense for the individual, like in my land, is a landscaping job. But if I don't pay attention to the root needs of the trees and the plants and whatnot, it won't be as beautiful as paradise could be. So taking the first step to sustainability puts us on the road to paradise. And heaven, by the way, is just a good mindset. And heaven is everyone's responsibility. Like a city's paved in gold, geez, that's hard on your back. And it scratches the gold, and it wouldn't look like much after a while. And that's about all the religions have to say about paradise. That's not very exciting. They need to go to a real estate course, you know.
The kinds of changes that you envision. You know, I had mentioned at the beginning of this hour the global challenges that we're facing, overpopulation and our inability to deal with poverty and hunger around the planet, at least so far. The kind of paradigm shift that you're talking about, is there enough time to realistically change things around before one or the other of these challenges wipes us out or does some serious damage?
George, I think that the latent ability of people and maybe some galactic support, maybe a lot of galactic support, the common new awareness on the web that everybody has, but it's not been credentialed exactly right. They don't really know they're a planet yet, but that can pop in a fairly short period of time. I think this is a lot like the reversal in the third act of a movie. You know, we are right on the edge of it. And I think universe, creative as she is, is making this push on us to pop us through. And if we don't pop it through by ourselves, then okay, she's going to bring the rest of the galaxy in, and it's going to be an amazing event. And by the way, most of the extraterrestrials we'll see will be former graduates of Earth, for crying out loud. Who else would they be?
What does that mean? What do you mean?
I mean, people who have ascended from lifetimes on Earth and living other places will be the people who come back. They don't all have to be lizards and things and gray things with big black eyes. They'll mostly be former members of planet Earth, our elders, our ancestors. I don't know how we got the whole thing skewed off into little gray people, but I guess it makes for mystery stories or something. But
well, yeah, it's a good story, and maybe it's all of the above. Maybe there are little gray people.
I'm hoping it's all of the above. But I would say the preponderance of the people who would come back to see us at graduation will be our people, our mothers and fathers and grandfathers and stuff. Now, okay, it's a speculation, but I see that we've got a lot of clues that we are in school on planet Earth.
And I agree with you.
The school lasts 2,600 years. And at the end of the school, you hope that you've solidified and unified a planet. That would be a perfect ending graduation exercise for the school.
Jim Channon, hang on. We're going to open up the phone lines and let our listeners ask questions when we come back. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast AM.